Welcome to This Is Money podcast, brought to you in partnership with Charles Stanley Direct, the award-winning investment platform trusted by over 40,000 clients. Investment involves risk. I'm Georgie Frost, and alongside me today is editor Simon Lambert. And Kelsa Breeze, we are officially in recession, but what does it mean for us? And is it all gloom and doom as the figures would suggest? Well, it's not all gloom and doom, as it seems. Lockdown has turned Britain into something of a nation of accidental savers, with more of us paying down our debts. Also today, green shoots as well of recovery in the property market. But how long will it last, and will first-time buyers be the winners or the losers in all of this? Plus, we've tips to keep your retirement plans on track, as young people particularly stop putting money into their pensions due to coronavirus. And with Brexit on the horizon, we take a look at the best of British cars. And don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. But first, we're officially in recession. It was confirmed this week by the ONS in what Simon has said managed to be both important and perhaps the most meaningless piece of news this year. Let's be honest, shutting down businesses and telling everyone to stay at home was never going to be good for the economy. The 20.4% decline in GDP from April to June was the worst quarterly drop on record. But what does it really actually mean for you and I? And are there any positives, any green shoots, anything in those pretty horrendous figures that can make us feel a little bit better? Simon, what does being in technical recession actually mean, by the way? Economics 101.
It means that you've had two consecutive quarters of what is wonderfully termed negative growth. Negative growth is basically going backwards. It's a contraction in the economy. So in the first quarter of 2020, GDP was down 2.2%. GDP, gross domestic product, the measure that we use to work out the total output of the UK economy, all of the stuff that we do and make and sell, and all that kind of stuff. 2.2% in a quarter is pretty bad, actually. It's not great. Yet there was absolutely no doubt whatsoever that the April to June figures were going to make for much more unpleasant reading, and that we were definitely going to fall into recession. I mean, usually you get a sort of will they, won't they scenario where you closely watch the figures. Are they going to be negative? Are we just going to slip in? Or sometimes you get a, it's so bad, we're definitely going into recession. This time, I mean, it was almost meaningless, what we'd done to the economy by going into lockdown. So the ONS has said that the 20.4% decline between April and June it stacks up as basically the worst amongst all developed nations, which is a rather depressing piece of news, because we also managed to have put in an absolutely dire performance in the UK on coronavirus deaths. Now, you would have hoped that you would get one or the other, that you would either get a very, very severe hit to the economy, but, you know, you managed to limit the deaths, or you would have accepted that people were going to die of coronavirus, and it was almost an inevitable scenario, and that you were, you know, that you were going to try and protect the vulnerable, but you weren't going to shut down the economy and the economy's performance wouldn't be so bad. Instead, the government's levelling up has managed to level both figures up, which there will be an inquest into that over many, many years. It's all rather depressing.
I imagine as much as you sort of agree with whatever those figures may be, they have been sort of downgraded and apparently working on three different figures and who knows whatever, and figures, right? This is not good news, but it was inevitable.
No, the government manages to be pretty much stumbling from blunder to blunder on a daily basis at the moment.
I was trying to be fair, but that's all right.
We're knocking out all kinds of figures at the moment. And it's the question is that, yes, they had to revise those figures, but why were they even using the other ones? Who knows? Let's not get into the argument about coronavirus, etc. On the economic front, things are pretty bad. The ONS said it's actually better to look at the figures between the start of the year and June, because different economies around the world got hit by coronavirus at different times. They've all suffered, they've all gone into lockdown. But if you think about, if you remember back in March when we went into lockdown, some of the European countries had gone in a week or two before us, and so on and so on. So over the 6 months, the economy contracted 22.1%, which is only the second worst. Spain was
worst. I was going to say, Spain is worse, isn't it? Yeah.
At 22.7%. Compare that to France, 18.9%. Compare that to Italy, 17.1%. Compare that to Germany, 11.9%. And the United States, only 10.6%. That is a recession so deep, it has wiped 17 years off the UK's output. As I mentioned in my column this week, that takes us back to 2003. A year when Boris Johnson was mainly known for clowning around on Have I Got News For You. England dramatically won the Rugby World Cup. I bet you remember that one, Georgie. And we were first exposed to the White Stripes riff that has gone round and round and round and round in our heads and our sports stadiums and so on and so on. Yeah. And even got chanted at Jeremy Corbyn when they went to number one with Seven Nation Army. But why was it so bad in the UK is the question that you do have to ask. Because actually, when you do think back to when we went into lockdown, I had friends in family in France, in Italy, places like that. And the UK's lockdown was severe, okay? Everybody, you know, pretty much down tools. Everybody who could started working from home. You were only meant to go to the shop once a day and so on and so on. But it did seem to be a considerably more voluntary effort than the very policed ones in continental Europe.
Yeah.
But the key is how dependent our economy is on the consumer. And consumer spending tanked by 23.1%, according to the ONS, as lockdown arrived. But amazingly, that drop in household consumption was responsible for an astonishing 70% of the shrinking economy. That just goes to show how much we are dependent on consumer spending. Consumer spending falls 23%, economy contract. That accounts for 70% of the economy's contraction.
If we're looking at lessons to be learnt from this, I'm sort of going off on a tangent here, but is that one of them? Because there has been arguments. I mean, of course, there's been arguments in the past, you know, the 80s, the 90s, when industry was shut down, that actually we are too reliant. And is it time to sort of reassess the structure, can I put it that way, of our economy and what makes it up and the industry is involved?
It is perhaps, but we've been having this conversation for years and we don't really seem to be able to pivot away from it. I remember some kind of March of the Makers thing in the wake of the financial crisis when we were going to shift back towards manufacturing. And we have tried to position ourselves to be more like Germany, for example, which specializes in high-end manufacturing. So it's not pile them high, sell them cheap. Manufacturing. It is the stuff that is really, really, really in demand, really specialist. And Britain is very, very good at that stuff. But we haven't managed to pivot our economy away from the consumer spending element. There's probably too much of the economy that is still dependent on things such as rising house prices, people buying houses, people going out to eat. A lot of the economy now appears to consist of people getting takeaways and taking Ubers.
Yeah.
It did before coronavirus. The Uber thing has died down a bit, but takeaway sales are definitely on the up. We just don't really seem to be able to do it. And we're very services heavy and we do a lot of service-based stuff. The concern is that who expected that we were going to do what we did? Nobody expected that we were going to literally push the pause button on the entire economy. So that is something of a black swan moment. Arguably, if we had to do it again, would we do it again is the question, but in the same way? Possibly not. Arguably, if we had to do it again, would businesses be more resilient? Would spending be more resilient? Would the consumer mood be more resilient? Probably, because people have been through it once already. Businesses would now have a plan in place for if everything shut down again. They do have a plan in place. People would go, okay, well, yeah, this is really terrible, but we got through it last time. We can get through it this time. And there are things that once you went a few months into lockdown, you did start to see this little mini spending boom around certain treat, big ticket items and things like that. And we're going to talk about in a minute. So But it still is very, very consumer dependent. I don't see any way that we really pivot our economy away from that in the decades to come.
Maybe we won't have a choice. Maybe this is inevitable. It depends how long this lasts and what our reactions are going to be to it. But it may just be that the way it was in the past is not possible to continue anymore. But I want to get into the fact that, are we actually still in recession? Because if something goes so low, and I do understand that we've grown a little bit, which is not a surprise, because if you close all the doors and then you open a few of them, it's going to be better than everything being shut. So our economy is technically growing, I guess, is it not? And so therefore, are we even in recession anymore?
Well, in the next set of quarterly figures, we'll cover the period of June, July and August. We're still in August. We've seen June's figure. June had quite a big bounce back, up 8.7% GDP in June. And in fact, May saw it go up by 2.4%. Most of the damage was done in March and April. February saw zero, so it's flat. And then March saw a 6.9% contraction. April saw a 20% contraction. Arguably, it's highly likely that both July and August have been positive. And we could find ourselves in the weird position of coming out of recession quite soon. Would we really have come out of recession? No, not at all. You know, this is the thing. It was just that the shock was so dramatic that you would inevitably get this uptick afterwards. But that doesn't really mean you're out of recession. And the big concern now, of course, is not these GDP figures, because they're important, but they're backward looking. They're a lot more prompt than they used to be, because we now get monthly figures, but they are backward looking. GDP is not even the greatest measure at all in itself. In fact, you should probably use GDP per capita, GDP per head, rather than overall GDP. And there's been an argument for that for years, but we don't use that as the official statistic. But it's the concern about the job losses that are coming through and the wave of them that are going to come through when the furlough scheme ends, and what damage that's going to do to the economy, because that's going to be a longer, slower burn than the let's push that button that shuts everything down.
Is there a little bit of you that's optimistic that this much talked about V-shaped recovery is, these are the green shoots, that 8-point-something figure is the start of greater things, Simon?
Well, to use our old friend Wile E. Coyote, Arviva just watched him run off a cliff, and he's standing there looking backwards at Roadrunner and the cloud of dust that he left as he went off the cliff, thinking, hey, what's going on here? I just seem to be standing in midair. This is all right. I'm doing okay. And he's about to plummet to the ground.
Yeah.
Or alternatively, I'm seeing quite a lot of stuff out there that makes me think maybe there might be more to the stronger than expected recovery. Maybe not the V-shaped one, but maybe there might be a bit more to this than people think, because, you know, there is no shortage of people spending money out there. I talked about the indicators you can look out for, the things that might indicate that things are a little bit better. And you've got house hunting, okay, right? It seems literally ludicrous, and compared to what we were talking about in May before the property market reopened, you know, about how there was just no way that it could not be completely sideswiped by this. It's not. It's having this little mini revival, which, yes, that's pent-up demand from it being shut over its kind of busy spring period. But that's not fizzled out yet. Even though there's been a bit of a mortgage crunch for first-time buyers, people are actually getting out there and moving home. And there are people that I'm talking to who are saying, yeah, well, we want to do it now before the stamp duty holiday runs out. I mean, the problem is with stamp duty holidays, if you've got more people going out and doing it, you might save 15 grand on the stamp duty, but pay 25 grand more for the house. But people are going, right, come on, let's do it. And I think there is this, I don't want to put my life on hold, I'd quite like to move house element going on. So you've got house hunting, you've got mortgage approvals, which are doing pretty well. New car sales, we talked about that last week, they were up. People eating out, albeit with Rishi's help, but people are definitely eating out. Things like takeaway sales, all of these things point to considerably more consumer confidence than you would expect. This is not a picture of a nation hunkering down. In the meantime, good luck buying a hot tub, an expensive bike, an e-bike, a fancy garden sofa set, an expensive sun lounger, or booking a holiday let in the UK, the UK is full for the whole of the rest of August, pretty much. Within, you know, try doing that within the next couple of weeks. You won't be able to get those things for love nor money, or you'll have to pay through the nose to get them. Now, we probably, as we were talking about earlier, want to pivot our economy a little bit further away from some of this stuff in the future. But in the short term, it does all bode quite well for a bit of recovery in a consumer-dependent economy. Meanwhile, there's a lot of talk about city centres being dead, the problems there, that, you know, the businesses suffering, the, you know, the pubs, the restaurants, the sandwich shops, the multinational chains that have large have problems with paying tax. I don't feel too bad for that. But how badly they're being harmed by people not going into the office. But if you go down the high street in the suburbs or the major towns, the streets, the cafes, the bakeries, the restaurants, everywhere is doing pretty brisk business at the moment. So, but is this just the wealthy spending? Are we basically seeing an even greater division of the haves and have-nots?
Exactly. I was going to say, listen to podcast past, we have spoken about the tale of two coronaviruses and how this is going to affect people in different ways. Some people will be initially very badly affected by the lockdown measures. Some will have lost their jobs, their businesses. Those people will probably not be spending. But I imagine if all the predictions are right, then many, many more people will not be spending come later on in the year when all these predicted jobs are going to be lost. I mean, it does sound to me as though we do like to spend anyway. We are a consumer spending economy, as you've just pointed out. So, you know, a little bit of something on the horizon is not going to put many people off. What will put people off is actualities, is the reality of losing your job. So we'll see, I imagine, a little bit later on. And that's why I suppose the recession figures are, well, like you said, they're important, but they're also not really relevant, because isn't things like unemployment, doesn't it have a lag period? And it's actually in the next few months that we're going to see what this really means for us.
Yes, and there is a division here. So there's, if you're employed and you've still got your job and you've still been paid throughout it, or you're self-employed and you haven't really taken much of a hit to your earnings. In fact, there are some people who are self-employed who said the business is really, really busy at the moment, then you probably aren't feeling the pain. But if you're not in that position, if you've lost your job, if you've been furloughed and lost a lot of wages from being furloughed rather than just ending up broadly even once you take out the cost of getting to work, if you're self-employed and have seen your income collapse, then you would be listening to all of the things that I have just said and tearing your hair out going, what are you talking about, mate? This is absolutely terrible. I mean, from a personal perspective, you know, I'm employed, so I get paid every month, you know, but my household has taken a hit. My wife has just had to do like her 6 months of accounts for, she's self-employed. And she said to me yesterday, she's going to earn about a sixth this year of what she earned last year. Mm-hmm. So that, I mean, that's a big, big decline. You know, luckily we can, you know, we can make it up, kind of thing. I'm all right, kind of thing. But if we weren't in that position, then we would have a real issue, because getting by on a sixth of what you would normally get in a year is not a good scenario. Now, obviously, hopefully things would pick up, because hopefully the children are going to go back to school and things like that. So people aren't going to have to be homeschooling. And one of the really interesting things in the jobs figures this week was that a lot more people just became economically inactive. So that meant that they weren't working, but they weren't looking for work either. And a lot of that is people who have just basically had to go, okay, well, I'm just going to have to look after the kids because they're not at school every day. I'm going to have to homeschool them. And you saw a drop in self-employed numbers as well. Again, I think that comes through from some of the tax data. And that is, again, an indicator that some of those self-employed people have just literally stopped work. And there's been a lot of people who have had to stop work in order to look after their children, which is why the government considers it so important to get kids back to school in September, which is why it's so unfortunate they've decided to stop some more kids going back to school in September by imposing a quarantine on France. But we won't get into that.
No. Listen to podcast past. We've got plenty. I'm still in Spain, by the way, avoiding quarantine back. But I think, to be honest, I'm not going to avoid it, am I, at all? There's one thing I want to ask you, because we're going to talk about pensions shortly, but and the fact that 40% of young people have cut back on saving for a pension or not saving at all at the moment. The worry with, I guess, those people who are economically inactive, as you were just talking about there, or people that, you know, don't pay into a pension or opt out of auto enrollment, is the number of people that don't go back in. And that, I suppose, is the concern. Too long out of something and you get a little, not you get used to it, but it does get much harder to get back in.
Yes. And so if you look at recessions past, the two in main memory over the last decades were the one after the financial crisis and the one in the early 1990s. Now, in the one after the financial crisis, unemployment never rose by as much as people expected it would, considering quite how bad the hit to the economy was, and quite how long lasting it was, because basically you were suffering the hangover from a massive credit binge. But unemployment remained relatively low compared to how high people thought it would go. And employment, after the initial spike in unemployment, started to climb back nicely. But you had a compression of wages. So real wages fell, and real wages only literally had only just got back above the 2007, 2008 levels. But people kept their jobs. And if people keep their jobs, then they can keep paying the bills and so on and so on. And people didn't lose their houses. There was a huge amount of pressure on the banks to show forbearance, which is a fancy word for saying not repossessing people. Yeah. And that is probably one of the most personally economically damaging things that can ever happen to you, is having your house repossessed, because you still owe the mortgage debt. You know, if the house is sold, and inevitably a repossession is sold for less money than the house is actually worth, because it's sold at auction, it's sold in a quick fire sale. You don't make it look pretty and, get the estate agent around and get some bids in. And you can end up having lost your house and still owing some money on the mortgage. Now compare that to the early 1990s recession, which was hugely damaging on a personal level for many, many people, because unemployment rocketed and was really sticky, and there were lots of people who just couldn't get back into work, particularly in some parts of the country, particularly in the north, things like that. There were industries that were decimated, and there was a huge wave of repossessions and people losing their homes, and people who then suffered the damaging economic consequences of that for many, many years afterwards. And it was only really that Blair and Brown boom era, some of which was fueled by the old credit binge, that puts back on our feet. So the question is which one do we get this time? You know which one you want to avoid. As bad as the financial crisis and the austerity years were, what you really don't want to have is the early 1990s one. So you don't want those people, as you said, stuck out of work for a really, really long period of time. The problem is we are possibly reshaping our economy as we speak, because are we going to need as many people employed in industries like travel and hospitality and things like that?
Certainly not at the moment. I do wonder, though, looking at some of the stats, and perhaps this is just my eternal optimism, that we're in a sort of, personally, we're in a better situation. Don't you get the sense that people are perhaps just a little bit more savvy about money than they were when the financial crisis happened? And a lot of the stories that we're reading, one of them on your website, according to Experian, borrowers have been using this time, those people that have that excess money that they've not been spending going out or commuting, to actually get on top of their debts. And it's an average, I think they found, £2,000 paid off credit cards and other borrowing, which... And that's just one piece of research. I've read quite a lot, and obviously it is individuals, but it does seem to me that perhaps people are bit more sensible about things. I mean, I don't know if you just said everybody's gone out and spent, but I'm hopeful.
No, well, you've got the rise of the accidental saver that I talked about. And under normal circumstances, actually, some of the stuff that you're hearing about, the amount people are paying off debts, credit cards, loans, the amount people are salting away into savings accounts, under normal circumstances, it would take forever and a day for that to happen. And people have done it in a few months because they've suddenly seen their outgoings absolutely slashed. And I know that I've spoken to plenty of people who have said that they have done this, anecdotally. And the figures from various places are bearing it out. So maybe people are a bit more resilient. Maybe people are a bit wiser to things. And actually, probably the fact that this is coming, within fairly recent memory of the post-financial crisis years, when I think people realise, right, that's it, you're on your own. You need to support yourself, basically the government is,
yeah.
you can't rely on the government kind of thing. I think that maybe people, that does impact people, and they think, okay, right, this is pretty bad. I'm going to stick this money away and pay this debt off. Obviously the problem is that it's actually quite bad for the economy.
yeah, exactly.
So what we need, we have this haves and haves not scenario, right? What we need is the haves. And this is not the people who've paid off some credit card debt and managed to actually save a couple of £1,000 for the first time in their life. The haves are the people who've got tens or hundreds of thousands of pounds or mortgages paid off or, you know, four cars on the drive and all that kind of stuff that they actually owe rather than they're just chipping on the monthly tab. It's those people that you need to go out and spend the money and support the economy while the people who are struggling can't spend. And if you can do that, then that's good. But what you don't want is the gap to keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger, because the hallmark of the post-financial crisis years was this, you know, this gap between the haves and the have-nots, the comfortable and the struggling, the intergenerational tension on wealth, you know, all that stuff. We need to learn from that. And maybe it's recent enough that we can learn from it. And I mean, the one thing that the people who got really done over after the financial crisis were young people. Compared to the older generation, there was the lack of opportunity, but also they kind of got things cut and they didn't really get that much help and support. And I think hopefully we could learn our lesson from that as well and support those people. I really felt for those poor kids yesterday with their A-levels.
Oh, God, it's an absolute disaster, isn't it? But I was going to say that the Chancellor has been, with his measures that were introduced in the summer statement, that they are supporting young people. Young people are their priority at the moment. And as I said, we mentioned earlier, first-time buyers and those young people not paying into a pension. The first-time buyers particularly have... I understand from the research that they're still very keen to buy, apparently, but the trouble is always getting the deposit. But the trouble has been those low deposit mortgages. It looks better, does it, Simon? I mean, who's going to be the winners and losers? Because if this boom in house prices continues, or this green shoots, as we've called it, it depends who you ask, to be honest. If this continues, it doesn't look good for first-time buyers. But if, as predicted, house prices fall, perhaps it does. Although if you can't get a decent mortgage, then it's not going to be great. Can we make any predictions, or shall I just throw this in the I hate house prices bin?
I think you might have just summed up the perennial problems of the first-time buyer as they go round and round in circles trying to work things out. Ultimately, though, you can't hold a good first-time buyer down, and people still want to own a home and they still want to buy a home. All those factors. And in fact, lots of people say, well, do you know what? You can have too much information, and it's just, I just want my own place, and I'm really happy to have my own place. And I'm going to, don't care about what's going to happen to the house prices. I'll be here for long enough that it'll be okay. I mean, the tip is just to make sure that you buy somewhere that if house prices do fall and you do end up unable to move, that you don't find yourself in a position where you're going, oh, we really need to move and we can't.
Yeah.
The scenario for a first-time buyer at the moment is a tricky one, because you've got this mortgage crunch. So unless you've got a bigger deposit, you've got less mortgages on offer. You've then got the property market having picked up rather than sunk, which people might have thought. Well, which everybody did think was going to happen, and the mortgage lenders thought was going to happen, and that's why they cracked down on their mortgages. You've then got the, will it just sink in a few months' time? Will it fizzle out? But then you've got the scenario where for many of those people, it would actually be cheaper to have a mortgage or own their own place than it would be to pay their rent. And that, I think, gets to the crux of the matter. If renting was substantially cheaper every month than paying the mortgage on a similar property, people would probably be more happy to rent for a longer period of time and not be so worried about getting their own place. But in many instances, they are merely paying someone else's mortgage with their rent and a bit of profit and ending up spending more than they would do on a mortgage. So you can totally understand why first-time buyers are keen to buy. Now, the good news, I suppose, is that the big saving on this stamp duty stuff is further up the ladder. It's up towards the 500 grand limit. The 15 grand comes if you spend 500 grand. And the bit of the property market that's flying at the moment is actually the upper end of the property market. It's the more expensive homes. It's the stuff above 500 grand, you know, and in parts of the country where houses are expensive, it's the 500 grand, £1 million, £1.5 million kind of places. So although there's lots of talk about how busy the property market is, maybe the first time buyers who are buying more in the like £200,000 to £300,000 bracket aren't going to be feeling that competition quite as bad as you might think from the headline figures. But there are some things that you should do if you are a first-time buyer, just to make sure that you know what you're doing. Firstly, you know, work out what deposit you need. How much have you got? What's in your savings? Check up your mortgage options, see how much it's going to cost you. Sort out your finances before you apply for a mortgage. You're going to get asked about your spending. They're going to go through your bank statements. You need to check your credit score. They're going to work on affordability. Affordability might be tighter now, but you know, people will still be surprised. Find a good mortgage broker, speak to a good mortgage broker who can help you. Some of those are fee free. Bear in mind that you need to not get carried away when you're looking at properties. Find a property you like, and if you like it and you think, right, this is the one, go for it. But don't go for it to the extent where you overstretch. Be careful about things like freehold and leasehold. A lot of new build flats and new build houses have been sold on a leasehold basis. Some of them have got these rising ground rents that are causing real problems for people. So just be very, very sure that you know what you're doing there and read up about that. Once you've found a place, put in an offer, go low. You're a first-time buyer, you're chain-free, so you're not dependent on selling something in order to buy. And you can always negotiate up, but it's very difficult to negotiate down. People get very reluctant to put in offers because they feel like, well, it just sounds like I'm just asking for so much money off. But you know, the asking price might be overinflated anyway. And in fact, it's quite often that's the seller that comes from. It's not from even from the estate agent. The seller thinks their house is worth more. The estate agent wants to get the house sold, so we'd probably rather put it on for a slightly lower price. If a place isn't selling, estate agents quite often welcome lower offers because then they can say to the seller, you've put this on for too much. Or these, but also speak to estate agents, make friends with the estate agent. You don't have to like, you know, go around. Well, you can't go around the house. I don't know. Can you go around the house? I'm not sure. Anyway,
depends where you are.
Depends where you are and how many you are. You
social actually, distance with a mask.
You can't have more than six estate agents around your house at any one time. Yeah. But look, get on good terms with them so that you find out when properties are coming on and let them know that you're a good buyer, that you're reliable and things like that. And then just know about all the costs that you're going to face. You've got surveyor's costs. Do get a survey done. Mm-hmm. Don't wing it on the survey, because if there's any problems, it will bring them up and you will then be able to negotiate those off the price, hopefully, rather than them biting you in the backside after you've bought the place. And there's nothing worse than buying somewhere and suddenly discovering you've got a £5,000 bill for it. Trust me, I know. I've been there.
Yeah, speak from experience there.
Exactly. And stamp duty, first-time buyers are exempt. Everybody's exempt up to £500,000 at the moment. But you're going to have to pay solicitors' costs, etc., and so on. So just get wise up on all of this, know about mortgages. Your best bet is probably to take a fixed rate mortgage. You could take a tracker which follows the Bank of England base rate. The Bank of England base rate is probably as low as it's going to go. We've said that before. Amazingly, it managed to go lower, but it's at 0.1%. It's not got very far to go now. Tracker mortgages are probably going to get slightly more expensive, and actually the margin on them is quite high now, whereas fixed rates are pretty cheap. A two-year fix sounds like a great deal because it's really low, but you'll be surprised how quickly 2 years goes. Most people spend about 4 to 5 years in a property. Might be worth considering a longer-term fix. And go to thisismoney.co.uk/mortgages and read our How to Purchase a Property in a Pandemic guide for first-time buyers.
You took the words out of my mouth there. While you're on fire, Simon, I want you to give some tips as well to younger pension savers, because I mentioned there about a little bit earlier about how 40% of young people have cut back or have completely stopped altogether saving for a pension because of coronavirus. I mean, I think it's across the board we're seeing this of all age groups, but it is particularly 18 to 35 year olds who are most likely to stop. And it's those people that the little and often compounding interest can make such a difference. So just give us a few tips on what you can do in this scenario.
Yeah, I must admit, myself and Tanya Jeffries were talking about this the other day when she was writing the story, and we were surprised that actually the figures were so high, that so many had cut back due to auto enrollment. That's what's really boosted pension saving. But I guess there's been, you know, job losses, and there's been furlough as well, and this has disproportionately hit younger people who might only be saving a very small amount into the pension, but they were still saving into a pension. If you're still employed and you're still earning money, do keep paying money into your pension is the short answer to that. You know, just the quicker you start, the sooner you start even, and just paying in a little amount, the more it compounds over the years, the more employer contributions you get, the more contributions you get from the government in terms of tax relief, and the more it will build up and the easier it gets to save for your retirement. So ideally, you want to really try to avoid cutting back and putting money into your pension. Or if you do, don't take it down to zero. And then make sure that once you're earning more money again, that you pick it back up. Those are really just the crux of the tips. And also check what your pension's invested in. A lot of people will be in default funds, a lot of which are very broad, cover the whole world, cover different assets, and that's fine. But if you are younger, you can probably largely afford to invest in shares, perhaps 100% or 80% in shares. You don't really need to hold that much in bonds. And you want to make sure that it's spread all around the world because surprising things happen. For example, the US was one of the world's most expensive stock markets before the coronavirus crash. The US stock market crashed like every other stock market. And then the US stock market has gone completely mental since and is up loads and loads and loads. You never would have predicted that. You would have said this will be the thing that finally takes the top off the US stock market. It didn't happen. So if you invest all around the world, just keep putting the money in and, you know, not worrying too much about things, then you can just sit back and allow your pension savings to grow.
Very good. Thank you very much, Simon. Just to end the podcast today, I mean, it's weird, isn't it, when you think that Brexit, talking about Brexit is sort of a bit of a welcome relief from talking about, I never thought I'd say this, from coronavirus, but we're going to be talking about, hello, Brexit. And European-built cars imported to the UK are set to become around $1,500 more expensive from next year. Homemade motors are expected to be in higher demand than ever before. This is after the government confirmed back in May that vehicles imported from the EU will be subject to a 10% tariff from 2021. Trade bodies have been warning that manufacturers will pass these charges on to buyers in Britain. But fortunately, there is a way to get around the unwelcome price rises, and this is, of course, by buying new cars that are assembled in UK factories. So what are the options for homegrown automotive talent? Just a question. Is it different saying a car assembled in a UK factory or a UK car?
Or a British-made car. Right. Yeah. So if it's been built here, but you might find that parts of it have been assembled overseas and then it's come over here to be finished off. I mean, the car manufacturing process involves a huge amount of travel across borders. And even if a car was made here in the UK and assembled here in the UK and put together, it might contain lots of parts that were not made in the UK at all. But we're talking about cars that count as British built, basically here. Our resident flag-waving patriot, Rob Hull, our deputy motoring editor. Well, he might have an Arsenal flag. He doesn't wander around waving a Union Jack all the time. Has gathered together the best of the bunch, what he thinks are the best of the bunch. And as you know, when you look down this list, you realise that there are some pretty good cars that are made in the UK. So we've got...
It is with them.
Okay, so I won't tell you all of them. Yeah. I won't tell you all of them. But in the small car category, we've got the Nissan Juke. We have got the Mini Hatchback, made in Oxford. We have got the Nissan Leaf electric car, a very good electric car nowadays, made in Sunderland. Then shifting up to the medium car category, we have the Toyota Corolla, made in Derbyshire. We have the Vauxhall Astra, made in Ellesmere Port in Cheshire. We have the Honda Civic, still made in Swindon, Wiltshire, although that won't be for much longer. Into the larger cars and small SUVs category, these are the ones that people love to buy, these small SUVs. The Nissan Qashqai. Britain loves a Nissan Qashqai. We even had Qashqai Man, didn't we? The replacement for Mondeo Man last time around. The Jaguar XE, that's a saloon car, made in Castle Bromwich. Hasn't been as successful for Jaguar as it would have hoped. This was the car that was going to take it to the BMW 3 Series. Unfortunately, the world decided that they wanted to buy SUVs. So Jaguar hasn't been as successful as it deserved with the XE because it's a really good car. The Range Rover Evoque, very, very popular. Then large SUVs, Okay, here we start to move into some serious money territory. The Bentley Bentayga, built in Crewe, Cheshire. Yours for £146,700. As long as you don't add any extras, and then the price starts going up substantially. If you can't quite stretch to a Bentayga, you could get yourself a Jaguar F-Pace for £41,870, or a Range Rover Velar, which is a bit more expensive, at £45,000. Luxury SUVs, Aston Martin's new DBX, just released, more expensive than a Bentayga, £158,000. This is the car that they hope is going to save Aston Martin, because the world's gone so mad for SUVs that what are known as hugely famous sports car making names are now knocking out more SUVs than anything else. We then have the Range Rover SV Autobiography. This is the priciest Range Rover you can get your hands on. And the Rolls-Royce Cullinan. That costs a mere £264,000, more than most people will spend on a house. And let's just say its looks have divided opinion. It's a bit brutal, to be honest.
Right.
Executive
not your
cars.
Car of choice, okay.
No. Jaguar XJ, Rolls-Royce Phantom, Bentley Flying Spur, sports cars. You've got the Lotus Elise, very lightweight, very small, very different to a Rolls-Royce Cullinan. Jaguar F-Type, and the Caterham 7. Again, that's a quirky car. And then luxury sports cars, we've got the McLaren 570S, Aston Martin Vantage, the Bentley Continental GT. And then Rob has thrown in a couple of wild cards just to show the weird stuff we can do in the UK. The Aerial Nomad. Basically, a car that just looks like it's got the frame of the car and they've forgotten to put the rest of it on. Really fast, really lightweight. Is like nothing else that is legal to drive on the road, and you can drive it off the road as well. The Morgan three-wheeler, you've got to love the fact that Morgan still make these, and you've got to love the fact that people still buy them. And then the Eagle E-Type. This is basically an E-Type Jaguar upgraded for modern day performance and roads, stripped out, lightweight, really, really wonderful cars. £650,000.
Ooh.
If I could have any of these cars, I would have the Eagle E-Type, and not just because it's the £650,000 one.
Why else would you have it? What's the draw for you?
Oh, I love an E-Type, and I love what they've done with them. So,
did you get any offers to buy you a car the last time we were touting around whether you could?
No, we didn't actually.
No. Surprised about that one. It's well, if anybody does want to get Simon the E-Type, £600,000, do get
yes, yes.
Do
or if the guys from Eagle are listening and they just want to lend me one for a short while, I'd be very happy about that as well.
Yeah, you could write a story about it, or you know, go to. I was going to say you could go to France. Can't do that now.
No
shame. Anyway, thank you very much, Simon. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into or to buy Simon a car, Simon?
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney, or you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast, join in the debate and read your comments.
You can buy me a car as well. It's fine. I've got one though, but it's fine. And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us. The This Is Money podcast is brought to you with Charles Stanley Direct. Open an account today and start saving for your future. Investment involves risk.